The funeral procession left at dawn and rode through the quiet streets of Ascalon, bearing the body of the beloved hermit on a black-draped bier drawn by two of Toli's finest white horses. It went to the north, where Pelgrim Forest met the plain at its closest point to the castle, a distance of about a league. The day was fair and warm, the sun rosy gold on the treetops as it climbed into heaven's great bowl of cloud-scrubbed blue. The air held the sweetness of wildflowers that grew in haphazard clusters across the tableland. Pink and yellow sun lilies, buttercups, and blue buttons. Toli rode Riv and led the bier. Esme and Bria followed. And Alenia came in a coach with Princess Brianna on one side and Princess Elena on the other. Nearly 70 mourners made up the cortege, lords and ladies, knights, squires, household servants, and townspeople, all friends of the hermit, for he welcomed every man, whether of high position or of meaner birth, as friend. And though their errand was a sad one, the day was so bright and the feeling of life so intense that it was not possible for any of the mourners to remain genuinely sorrowful.
How strange it is. Today I feel newly cleansed, as if the past days have been an unhappy dream that vanished with the dawn.
I feel the same way. And yet I have not changed. The whole world seems to be newborn.
They continued to talk this way, and behind them in the coach, the little princesses plied their grandmother with questions. Princess Elena had never attended a funeral, and Princess Brianna only that of Yesif. But she had been a baby less than a year old, and didn't remember it.
Grandmother, what happened to Darwin?
Nothing bad, my child. His body will rest now in the earth.
But won't he get cold?
No, never again.
I know what will happen. He will turn into bones.
How awful! Will I turn into bones too?
Not for a very long time, my dear one. But someday, yes, everyone does. And their bones turn into bones and dust.
I do not think I shall like it.
I will.
I do not believe you will even know what has happened, nor will you care. He will begin a wonderful new life somewhere else.
Where? Oh, tell us about it, Grandmother.
Very well. There is a great kingdom far away, the kingdom of the Most High. When you die, you will go there and live with him. It is a wondrous place, more beautiful than anything you have ever seen. You will leave your body, you will not need it anymore, because you will have a new body, and go live in happiness forever.
Is that where Darwin has gone?
Yes, that is where Darwin has gone. He has gone to be with the Most High.
Will we see Derwin again when we get there?
Of course, he will be waiting for us.
And Grandfather Escobar too?
Yes, Escobar too.
Oh, I shall go at once then. I would love to see Grandfather.
It would make us sad if you went right away, dear one, for then we would not see you anymore. Stay with us a little while longer, please.
Very well, I will. I would not like to leave you, Grandmother.
They reached the site and brought the bier to the grave that had been prepared the day before. It was just a little way inside the forest, on the bank overlooking a shaded pool, the pool in which Derwin had waded many times, gathering his healing plants. Alenia had chosen the spot, remembering how he had loved to come here to wade or just to sit and contemplate. Many times she had found him stretched out on the bank and sat with him as he talked about this or that herb, or traced his musing about the Most High.
Quentin shall be here, and Garin. How they both loved Derwin. I wish they were here.
Bria was quite over her trauma of the night before. In fact, she did not really remember it as having happened to her. It belonged to the dream, the bad dream she left behind with the new day.
They will come here soon, I am certain.
Esme watched her friend closely, looking for any sign of the malady that had stricken Bria. Bria caught her scrutiny.
I am much better now.
She glanced toward the grave.
It is just that it does not seem right without Quentin here. He would be here if he could, you know that. Quentin's first duty is to find the prince and bring him back safely. The king cannot rest until his son and heir is safe. You are right. But look at Toli. It tears at my heart to see him like this.
Esme observed the slim, silent Jair and nodded sadly. It touched her deeply, too. She wished nothing more than to be able to go to Toli and comfort him. And she would have, but for fear of Tolly's rejection. For his part, Tolly had told no one but Phaedo of Quentin's harsh words. Those had been his due. He had deserved them. He signaled to several of the lords and knights in attendance, and they moved to the bier. Laying hold of the long plank on which the body rested, they lifted it to their shoulders. Bria and Esme went to the litter too, and Alenia. They took up bouquets of flowers that had been placed on the funeral pyre early that morning, and followed the body to the grave. The men lowered the hermit's body into the hole, dug in the rich black dirt. Sunlight filled the hole and fell on the pallid face. He seemed to be at rest, content. But he was not the same Derwin they had known. He had changed. In death, he appeared so much less himself that it was impossible for any of the mourners to look upon him as the man they knew in life. Derwin, the true essence of the man they had loved, was gone. He had left only a worthless husk behind. Alenia went to the graveside and knelt to place her flowers by him in the ground. Bria joined her and Esme. Tolly stood silently over the open pit and watched, his eyes hard as polished stone. Others came to the grave too and paused briefly to pay final honor to the man. Here and there a tear sparkled in an eye, but there was no sobbing, no wailing, no evidence of unendurable grief common at so many funerals. All who had come knew that this interment was different. This was the burial of one of the Most High's trusted servants. And no one who looked upon the body in the grave felt that the man had ceased. The presence of his spirit was strong among them. It would be wrong to regard the holy hermit of Pelgrim Forest as having fallen into shadowy non-existence in the underworld of the gods. Even those who had never heard of the Most High or his great and wonderful kingdom believed that Derwin had gone to a far different, far better place. Inwardly, all who saw him in his grave wished their own deaths could be so, assured, dignified, and peaceful. And many believed that from that day forth, that Derwin was right about the Most High, for they too wanted to go where he had gone. When at last all had paid their respects to the body, Princess Brianna and Princess Elena being the last to lay flowers in the grave, Tolly and five knights shoveled dirt into the hole, and then one by one, the mourners took up stones and placed them on the tomb.
Quentin would have wanted him buried in the Ring of the Kings, but this is better, more fitting.
I agree. Here among the trees he loved, where wild things lived, this is where he belongs.
They turned then and made their way back to the castle, leaving any lingering sadness behind. All except Tolly. He stayed when everyone else had gone and stood unmoving over the grave for a long time. Then, at last, he mounted Riv and left, but he did not ride back to Ascalon Castle with the others.
Where's Tolly?
Esme swiveled in the saddle looking for him, but he was not among those who followed.
Strange. I do not see him anywhere. I thought he had come with the others.
Esme turned her eyes back toward the gravesite, but there was nothing to be seen. Tolly had vanished.
The prince? Here? By the gods, it is a mistake, a terrible mistake. You have implicated the High Temple in your schemes. I will not have it. Do you hear? I will not have it.
High Priest Pluel raved and tore at his hair. Nimrud sat with hooded eyes, watching Pluel vent his anger, but saying nothing. The High Priest came to stand in front of the white-bearded old man, hands on his hips.
The temple is in danger now because of you. This was not in our agreement. You never said anything about kidnapping. I will not have it!
At last, Nimrud had enough. He stood, shot a withering glance at the High Priest, and stalked to the door.
Wait! What are you going to do? Where are you going?
I am leaving. It is plain you have lost your nerve for our little diversion. I have no use for you. Goodbye.
No! You cannot do that. What about the prince? What am I to do with him?
Do anything you like with him. What do I care? He might make a serviceable acolyte, though I think his father might have something to say about that.
Stop! Come back! You cannot leave me like this! This was never my affair!
Nimrud stopped, with his hand on the latch.
Never your affair?
He turned suddenly, his eyes darting flames. Cluel saw the change and dropped back, his mouth gaping. Nimrod advanced on him, seeming to grow in height.
Was it my idea?
Who else? You are not suggesting it was mine.
None others. I merely indicated to you the danger to the temple if you did not act at once. It was your men who took the boy. It was their mistake. You are high priest. You are responsible.
No! You tricked me. I told you to
do... Exactly! You told me to do what needed to be done. We would not be here now if your stupid men had done their duty. I certainly never wanted it this way.
You must help me!
The shock and rage at what Nimrod had done to him subsided. In the new horror of perhaps facing the outraged king alone. Why, the Dragon King would hew him limb from limb for the attack on his son.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I was not thinking clearly. Stay and help me think of what to do.
Nimrod pulled on his beard. He appeared to be contemplating what should be done.
Ah, so easy. This pigeon is so deftly caught. He has no nerve, no backbone. He deserves his fate. Ah, but I can use him, therefore I will save him. Oh, this is working so much better than I could have hoped. Ah, very well. I will stay. But you must stop whimpering and do as I say. I have a plan, a very simple plan. And if all goes well, in a short while, you, my pigeon priest, will hold the king in the palm of your plump hand.
Working outward from the place where the prince was last seen, Leto and Ronsard and their search party of knights combed the forest, fanning out from that central point, probing deeper into the heart of Pelgrin. The knights rode the shaded pathways and dimly lit trails. Leto and Ronsard rode with them, meeting at prearranged spots to confer and share any news. There was precious little news to share. No one had turned up any sign of the abductors.
They appear to have vanished from the face of the earth.
We should have seen some sign of them by now.
Leto gazed at the sky overhead. The clouds held an orange tint as the sun spun lower in the trees.
It will be dusk soon, and too dark to search any further.
Ronsard scanned the sky through the open patches in the leafy canopy overhead.
Blast their bones! By the god, I had hoped to strike their rank today.
Ronsard looked at Thedo, whose eyes held a faraway look.
What are you thinking?
Nothing. It was nothing.
I know that look of yours. Out with it, Thedo.
I was thinking about what Tolly said regarding Quentin's sword.
Now there is a puzzle. I wonder what is behind it.
Nothing good, you may be sure. I was thinking first now that it portends a greater evil than the prince's disappearance. And that is bad enough.
Aye, the Shining One? Not to be parted with lightly. I should have thought Quentin would fight to the death before giving it up.
You speak my thoughts to a word. And yet, when Tolly met him in the road, he did not speak of it at all. Why, I wonder?
Leto glanced at the sky once more.
Ah, well, one problem at a time, eh? We will start again at daybreak.
Yes, tomorrow. And that is the last good day. The signs, if they are out there, are already disappearing.
Leto turned his horse and made to move away.
Farewell, Ronsard. I will meet you tomorrow at the same time. If we have not found the trail by then, well, just pray that we find it.
Ronsard raised his hand in farewell and watched the tall, lean knight ride away, back along the way he had come.
Thedo is right. Something is at work here that bodes ill for all of us. What it is, we shall find out soon enough, I'll warrant.
Ronsard moved off through the deepening shadows to meet with his men once more, before he rolled himself in his cloak to sleep. All around, the wood lay still, as if contemplating the coming of the night. Ronsard felt a chill creeping out with the shadows, and with it, a sinister foreboding such as he had not felt in many years. He shuddered inwardly and rode on.
If you think it unwise, Mother, or if you would advise a better plan, please tell me.
Bria watched her mother carefully, almost breathlessly. Hers had been a sudden thought, and she had gone immediately to her mother's apartments to share her idea.
I do not say it is unwise, but I do have misgivings. However, I remember another time, years ago, when Derwin counseled the same plan. Then, too, it seemed a chancy enterprise. But it was the right course, as it turned out, though even Derwin could never have guessed the outcome.
Alenia smiled at her daughter, and Bria saw the light in her green eyes.
It seems that the destinies of Ascalon and Dekra are ever intertwined. Yes, my dear, go to Dekra. I will go too.
Mother, do you mean it? You would go.
Why not? I'm fit for a journey. And now that the King's Road is complete to Malmarby, the trip will be an easy one most of the way. But we must leave at once.
Alenia glanced at her daughter quickly.
What is wrong?
You spoke of misgivings. What are they?
Just that word may come to Ascalon about the prince, if you were not here to receive it.
I see. What should I do?
That I cannot tell you. You must do what any mother does. You must listen to your heart.
Then I will go to Dekra and speak to the elders there. We have often had reason to seek their wisdom, and their prayers may be most effective. I do so wish that Quentin were here, though.
Quentin will return soon. We will leave behind a letter telling him what we propose. He would wish to stay here in any case to aid the search.
What about Brianna and Elena? I fear leaving them.
They will come with us. Why not? They have begged to see Dekra often enough, and they will enjoy the trip. As it is, I think it would be unwise to leave them. We will take a coach and a bodyguard of knights and travel the safer.
Bria smiled, feeling better for having talked with her mother.
Yes. Naturally, you are right.
It will be better for us to have something to do. The waiting would weigh heavily on us, I fear. If word was long in coming... Well, we will go. We must not think of anything but Garen's welfare. The elders at Dekra will be able to help.
Bria gazed at her mother admiringly, and then threw her arms around her neck in a hug.
Oh, thank you. I knew you would say the right thing.
Poor Quentin. I pray that the waiting does not distress him overmuch. I would feel better if Toli were here. Perhaps he will soon return.
When should we leave?
Just as soon as the horses and supplies can be made ready.
Tomorrow morning, then. We will rest better in our own beds tonight and leave at first light.
Quentin gave Blazer his head and let the animal take them home. The road was easy to follow, and the horse knew the way back to Ascalon. Quentin rode without knowing or caring where they went, and Blazer unerringly led them homeward. As the way through Pelgrim merged green and leafy with the cool blue shadows, Quentin, benumbed from lack of sleep, felt himself drifting back to the strange meeting on the island. That he had been specifically summoned to the Holy Island, he had no doubt. By whatever subtle magic, he was drawn to the lake and there waiting when the boat arrived for him to take him to the Ring of Stones. Enchantment, surely, but for what purpose? Quentin could not say. As for the man, the mysterious stranger who spoke with him knew him, called him by name. Who was he? In some inexplicable way, Quentin felt that he knew that man, had known him for a long time, even though he had never met him before that hour. Or had he? It was as if a friend had gone on a long journey to a country far away and returned after many years, vastly changed, though still basically the same person underneath. And it was the change wrought in this man that shielded his identity.
Call me your friend, for friend I am.
I am in need of a friend. Sorely in need.
Quentin felt a loneliness take hold of him he had not felt in many years. Not since as a young acolyte in the High Temple had he experienced the same crushing weight of utter aloneness. In his mind, he traveled back to that time, and once again he was that gangly young boy, clinging frightened to the mane of the mighty warhorse Balder, setting out on an errand which could not possibly succeed, but going anyway.
Such hope. Such blindness. Ah, to be that trusting boy again.
Quentin felt the weight of years upon him, and tasted the bittersweet longing for that simpler, better time. He let himself drift off on waves of longing and loneliness. When he came out of his reflections, he saw that the sun was lowering over the road, and also that he was leaving the forest. Upon returning from the island, he had found Blazer waiting for him on the shore. He had beached the oxide boat and ridden away, not stopping all day. Now he felt the ache of the road seize him in an iron grip. His head throbbed. He rode out of the forest and down a slight hill into a broad valley. Here in this valley were the farms of peasants and small landowners, those who sold their produce in the market at Ascalon. Just a little ahead, Quentin saw the wattled house of a farmer, watched the man leading his team of oxen in from the field, and his wife at the well dipping water, and decided to stop for a moment to wash the dust of the road from his throat and to rest his horse. But only for a moment, because he wanted to be in Ascalon by nightfall.
Oh, there! Good day to you.
Quentin sat and waited for the farmer to show himself. A face appeared at a dark window, just a fleeting glimpse, and then it was gone. A moment later, the farmer came around the side of the house, carrying a two-pronged wooden pitchfork in his hand. He stared at Quentin warily, but with a certain respect.
Good day to you, sir.
The farmer's weather-browned face scrutinized the visitor frankly. If there was a trace of distrust, it was only the normal, benign distrust all simple people held for strangers who were obviously above them. Quentin smiled at the farmer.
It is a hot day for traveling, but good for the crops.
The farmer squinted his eyes up to the sky and seemed to lose himself among the clouds scudding swiftly toward the horizon. At length, he rolled an eye back to Quentin.
Traveling's often thirsty business.
Now that you mention it, I would like a drink of water.
Help yourself.
The farmer nodded toward the well. Quentin slowly dismounted and walked to the well, feeling every ounce of the road in each stiff step. He settled himself on the edge of the stonework and took up the dipping gourd. He played out the braided cord, filled the gourd, and then took the brimming vessel to his horse. Blazer, his shining white coat now dusty brown-gray, plunged his broad muzzle into the water and drank deeply. As Quentin held the gourd, he noticed a movement in the doorway of the house nearby. The farmer's wife joined her husband, and Quentin fell under her sharp scrutiny. Quentin wondered what the woman was saying to her husband. When he turned around, he understood, for he saw a look of awe blossom on their ruddy features, the look that accompanied him whenever he made his way in public. It reminded him that he was the Dragon King. He looked at them, and they bowed low, both of them, awkward and self-conscious.
Rise, my friends.
I did not know it was ye, sir. I be your humble servant.
Quentin patted his dusty clothes.
How could you know, good man? I look more like a highwayman than a king.
The farmer's raw-boned wife nudged her man with an elbow, and he jumped forward at once and took the gourd.
Allow me, sire.
Quentin was about to protest, but thought better of it and allowed the man his pleasure, knowing that for years to come the farmer would tell his friends and relatives of the day he had watered the king's horse. Sitting on the edge of the well once more, Quentin turned his eyes to the house and noted its rude construction. Though it was a most simple structure, made from the cheapest materials, mud daubed over wooden sticks on a timber frame and topped with a roof of thatch, it was clean and all was orderly in the yard. It was identical to any number of households that stretched from one end of Mensendore to the other, from Hinsonby to Wood's End. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a quick flick of a shadow as it darted and disappeared around the corner of the house. He watched the spot for a moment and was rewarded by seeing a pair of wide, dark eyes and a pale forehead poke around the edge of the house once more. Quentin smiled and raised his hand, beckoning to the owner of those eyes to come out and join him. Presently, a grubby young boy stepped hesitantly around the corner, keeping his back pressed against the house, inching toward the stranger with the shyness of a wild creature of the forest. The dark-eyed youngster was dressed in a long hand-me-down tunic, resewn for him, no doubt, from one of his father's. The edges of this garment were frazzled and frayed, and the threads blew in the breeze like tassels. He stared at the newcomer with open curiosity and admiration, as much for the great warhorse drinking from the gourd his father held, as for the horse's rider.
Come here, boy.
The lad's mother rushed over to him and wiped his face with her dirty apron, rubbing spittle on his cheeks and chin. When the youth was presentable, she pushed him forward. The boy resisted, bashful before the king. Quentin nodded and smiled. The boy was a little older than Prince Garin, and though of more slender build, he had the same unruly dark brown hair.
It is the king! Show your manners!
Whether the youth understood who it was that waited for him or not, In his eyes, it did not greatly matter. Anyone who rode a steed such as the one that stood in the yard before him qualified as royalty, in his young opinion. His mother prodded him to stand before Quentin, where he gazed at his unshod feet and drew lines in the dirt with his toe. Quentin put his hands on the boy's slim shoulders.
What is your name, lad?
Rennie, sire.
Rennie. I have a boy just like you.
A knife diced at his heart with the words, for again he remembered that his own was gone.
His name is Garin. It is about your age.
Does he have a horse?
No, but he likes to ride. Do you like to ride?
The youngster's face suddenly saddened.
I've never been on a horse, sire.
The awful truth was out, and the boy felt better for it, for he brightened instantly.
But when I get big, I'll have a horse, and I'll be a knight.
I'm sure you shall. Would you like to ride a horse?
The dark eyes went wide and rolled toward the nearest parent for approval.
Oh, 'tis all he's ever wanted to do. 'Tis all he talks of.
Then today you shall have your wish, brave sir.
Quentin led the youngster by the hand over to where Blazer stood quietly. The horse seemed to grow in size as they approached, and Quentin felt Rennie's hand grip his tightly.
This one is a well-trained mount. He will not harm his rider.
With that assurance, Quentin picked the boy up and put him in the saddle. The boy wore a dazed expression, unable to fathom his immediate good fortune or sort out the innumerable sensations assailing him in this miraculous instant. The king handed him the reins and placed them just so in his hands. Then, when Rennie was situated, Quentin took Blazer's bridle and began leading him around the yard. The farmer and his wife stood together clutching each other, beaming happily as they watched their son ride the king's own stallion. Quentin, too, felt their joy. It felt good to laugh, and so easy. He had begun to think he would never laugh again. Rennie, for his part, celebrated the occasion with all the solemn pomp his young frame could muster. He sat rigid in the saddle, his back straight as any lance, eyes level, shoulders square. The very picture of a knight riding into battle, full of courage, the victory sure, the foe all but vanquished. Then Quentin showed the boy how to pull the reins to one side or the other to make the horse turn, how to make him stop and go. Rennie took in this information gravely, studiously.
Do you think you can remember all that?
Aye!
Then he is yours to lead. Ride him, young master.
Quentin stepped away from the horse, and Rennie, through a half-worried, half-exultant look to his parents, kicked his heels gently into Blazer's flanks, lifted the reins, and began to ride the horse around the yard. Blazer, champion of battle, high-spirited and fleet as the wind over the plain, behaved as docilely as any plow horse. He stepped lightly around the yard, circling the three spectators, tossing his head now and then, to the delight of all. When the ride was over at last, Blazer came to stand before his master. Before Quentin could reach up a hand, Rennie threw his leg over the pommel and slid from the saddle as expertly as any knight. He wore a look of dazzled triumph, which seemed to say,
I have ridden a king's horse! I will be a knight!
Well done, lad. Well done.
Rennie's parents ran forward to embrace him, as pleased for his good fortune as if it had been their own dream's fulfillment.
Oh, that's me boy!
What a brave man you are, me boy!
Quentin was moved by this spectacle of love between the members of this simple family. His heart went out to them.
Oh, thank you, sire.
The farmer's wife grabbed Quentin's hand and kissed it.
This be a proud day, sire.
There were tears of joy sparkling at the corners of the farmer's eye.
Me son, astride the king's charger.
There were no more words to describe the pride he felt.
Please, it is but a little thing. I was happy to do it.
You must stay to supper, me lord.
The farmer's wife blinked in amazement, realizing what she had said. She had just invited the king to supper in her kitchen.
Oh, my.
Well, I thank you, but I couldn't possibly...
Quentin stopped and turned toward the road. The shadows of evening were stretching across the land. The sun had grown into a great blazing red fireball as it touched the far horizon. He was tired, and the thought of climbing back into the saddle and riding on to Ascalon seemed repugnant at the moment.
Madam, I would be honored to partake of an evening meal with you.
At once her eyes grew round and her jaw dropped. She turned to look at her husband, who merely peered back at her with the same expression of absolute astonishment. Then she gathered her skirts and dashed for the house to begin preparing the meal. Quentin smiled to see her go.
My lord, allow me to look after your steed. He must be hungry after a long day's traveling.
Thank you. That'd be most kind.
The farmer led Blazer away to the small barn set alongside the house at the back. Little Rennie watched him go, his eyes still sparkling like stars. He had relived his momentous ride 100 times already in his mind. Quentin sat back on the edge of the well, folding his arms across his chest. Perhaps he should not have accepted the invitation. Maybe he should not delay on the road. But he could not go back on his acceptance now. Furthermore, he could leave before dawn and be in Ascalon early in the morning, and he could use the rest. Here, perhaps, he could forget his troubles for an hour, eat and sleep and forget.
Why are you sad?
Quentin stirred himself and looked up to see Rennie studying him carefully.
I was just thinking about...
Thinking about your own little boy? He's the prince.
Suppose I was. Yes, he is the prince.
And you're out searching for him. Bad men took him away. And we must all keep our eyes and ears open so as to see or hear about him.
Quentin smiled sadly.
Bad news does fly with eagle's wings. Yes, they all know what has happened.
All of Mensendor would know by now. His grief was not as private as he supposed. Nothing about him was private anymore. The Dragon King's life was gossip, legend, and song to them. What would they all think when they learned he had lost the flaming sword Jalakir, the Shining One, symbol of his authority and divine appointment? What would they say of him then?
Don't you worry, sire. You'll find the prince. You're the Dragon King. You can do anything.
Yes, we'll find him. Please let us find him.
The farmer returned from tending to Blazer and came to stand before the king, not daring to break in on his thoughts by speaking. He just stood there silently and waited. Quentin did not stir.
My lord, supper's setting.
The evening sky glimmered with the sunset. The soft white clouds were tinted pink and orange. The world seemed poised on a fine silken thread, perfectly balanced between night and day. Quentin stood. The thread snapped, and the world rolled on toward night. Deep in Pelgrin's Green Heart, Tolly paused beside a spring which trickled out from a hillock of white stone into a crystalline pool. He slid from the saddle and led Riv to drink, then knelt himself and cupped water to his lips. The westering sun tinted the sky with evening colors of dusty gold and pale violet, flaming the woodland greens and burnishing the boles of towering chestnut and hawthorn with a gleam like bronze. Soon night would cover the forest with her dark wing, and he would have to find a sheltered hollow or a dry thicket for the night. But something drew him on, tugged at him gently, urging him to go just a little further. So, after a last drink from the pool, Tolly heaved himself back into the saddle and pushed on, sending his senses ahead of him to sift the air for a clue, a sound, a flicker of color, a scent borne on the air, anything that would tell him what had pricked his instincts and was drawing him forward.
It has been too long since I was in the wild. My skills have grown dull. Now, when I need them most, how will I find the prince?
Tolly rode along, bending his trail here and there through the wood, straining into the gathering twilight. He stopped, held his breath.
What was that? Nothing.
He lifted his hands to send Riv forward once more, then hesitated. There it was again. Tolly knew beyond all doubt what it was.
How long has it been since I heard that sound?
Then Tolly placed his hand at the side of his mouth and answered the call. Tolly climbed down from the saddle to wait, his heart thumping against his ribs. Through a stand of slim young beeches, stepping among the low-hanging branches, they came. 3 Jair kinsmen dressed in skins and wearing deerhide pouches at their waists. They hesitated when they saw Tolly, but he made no move toward them, so the forest dwellers advanced.
Kaletoa Teohiahala Rinoa,
Tolly's native tongue meant.
You have come far south this leaf time.
The deer. It has been dry in the North Forest. I am Yona.
I am Toli.
The three Jair glanced among themselves, excitement mirrored in their deep brown liquid eyes.
Yes, we know. We have been watching you and recognized you. Everyone knows of Toli.
How many are with you?
40 men and their women and children. It is very dry in the north. Here in the south, the deer are fat and run slow. Three tribes are with us.
Have you room for one more before your fire this night?
The three looked at each other and smiled. They all but stumbled over themselves to be the first to lead him back to the Jair camp. The campfires were lit and venison roasted on spits over the flames, wafting a tangy scent among the trees and dome-shaped dwellings made of deerhide bark and twigs. Toli had not encountered another of his race for many years, and he walked into the Jair encampment as one walking back into his own past. Nothing had changed. Every detail of life for the nomadic forest people remained the same. The deerskin clothing, the meals prepared over open fires, the sparkling dark eyes watching everywhere, the timid children clutching their mother's legs, the old men squatting before the flames instructing the young boys in wood lore. All was exactly as he remembered it, the same as it had always been. His guides brought him to stand in the center of the camp. A good number of Jair had already assembled to see the stranger, and the sight of this Jair prince, dressed in the fine clothing of the light-skinned men, produced shy pointing as they discussed him. For here was one of their own. Some knew who he was and told the others, yet changed almost beyond recognition as a Jair. None of them had ever seen such a transformation. In a moment, there came a stirring at the outer fringes of the ring of onlookers, and a pathway formed through which passed a shrunken old man. He carried a long staff made from an ash sapling, on which were fixed the antlers of a buck. This ancient one leaned heavily upon the staff and tottered forward to stand before the visitor. At his appearance, all the other Jair became silent as they waited to see what their leader would do. For his part, Toli waited to be received by the venerated leader, hands held loosely at his sides, his eyes lowered as a sign of respect. The old man came near and stood before Toli, drawing himself up to full height, gazing at him with quick, sharp eyes.
Toli, my son, I knew you would come to us again.
Toli's eyes went wide with the realization of who it was that stood before him.
Hoet, it is good to see you, my father.
With that, the old man threw down his staff, put his arms around Toli, and hugged him to his breast. Toli, the hero of many of their most often told and highly regarded tales and legends, had come home. Tonight would be a celebration. A huge fire was made in the center of the village, and deerskin and woven grass mats unrolled and placed around the perimeter. And upon each mat, a large wooden bowl filled with fruit. Toli and Hoet were led to the place of honor to squat on their mat, while the choicest pieces of roast meat were passed to them. The other Jair all found places around the fire. Hoet hunched beside his guest and gazed at him thoughtfully, patting his arm or knee from time to time, as if to reassure himself that it was true after all, that Toli had returned. When hunger had been appeased, all eyes turned toward Toli and Hoet. As the honored guest who had been fed and pampered with ceremonious attention, it was Toli's turn to repay the favor by telling his people a story. He stood and raised his hands above his head for silence, in the tradition of the best storytellers. But before he could begin, Hoet stood too and laid a hand on Toli's shoulder.
I claim the first story in honor of our brother.
The Jair gathered around the shining fire. Toli sat down as Hoet raised his hands.
Now, one day long ago, in snow time when all the forest sleeps in white blankets, and the cold makes the deer's coat shaggy and warm, men of the white race came to the forest on horses. They ran wildly among the trees and noisily, for the deer fled from the sound of their passing, and we heard them from far away, for they had no forest feet. They came near our wintering place, though. They did not know this. We watched them from afar, and one night encircled them as they sat before their crude fire. When Winnowick's fire once more filled the earth with light, we approached these white men, and one of them attempted to speak our tongue.
Though they had all heard this story countless times, all strained after every word, as if it were uttered for the first time.
This one, Bushface, told us of grave danger in the forest. The vile Shoth pursued them with thirsty knives and hunting birds with poison in their talons. He asked for help. In this, Bushface showed much wisdom, for surely the white men would have sunk down to their death sleep before one more night had passed. Should we help them? I asked myself. The answer was not quickly coming. It circled around me like a young deer at a forest pool. For they were white men, the same who had cut down trees and killed the deer in numbers and made stone dwellings on the earth. But the Shoth are our enemy, as they are the enemies of all civilized people. So, I decided to help them, for Bushface was a man with much power in him, and there was with him a woman, a Kelniki.
It was a Jer word that meant wife of the leader.
Whose hair shone like the dancing fire. I did not wish the evil Shoth to have such fine hair hanging from their spears. And also with them was a young boy in whose eyes I saw the look of one who was chosen for greatness. I knew I must help them. But how?
Tully listened to the recital of the events that had changed his life forever, and it seemed that he was once again the young Jer sitting before the fire, as he had so many times, listening to the tales of his elders and the deeds of heroes of his race. He remembered back over the years to the day when the white men had come into their winter camp. They looked cold and frightened, and extremely awkward in his young eyes. But the strangers had horses. Oh, how he had wanted to ride a horse. He could still feel the thrill of seeing the animals for the first time up close. So beautiful, so graceful they were, and strong. In his boyish heart, he vowed he would give anything to ride one of those horses. So when Hoed's gaze fell on him, he had leapt quick as a fawn to present himself for the task of leading the white men through the forest to the wall of stone. Hoed had sent him then, and the rest had become legend among the people of the forest. Bushface he had come to know as Durwin, Hawknose became his friend Thedo, Firehair was the beautiful Alenia, and Kenta, the boy with glory on him, he chose as his master, Quentin, now become the Dragon King. In the eyes of his kinsmen, Tully had acceded to the highest of honors serving a man of renown. For though he was of the white race, Quentin was also the leader of his people, and that for the Jer gave Tully the highest acclaim. There was no higher position a Jer could aspire to than to fulfill the role of servant to a great leader.
And so, he has returned this night to us, to his own people once again. The glory of his deeds casts Winnowick's favor upon all of us, and we are accounted worthy.
The old chieftain turned proudly to his guest.
If they only knew how I have failed, would they still receive me with celebration and feasting? No. No, they would disgrace and shun me. My name would no longer be spoken among them. I would be forgotten.
When Tully turned again to those before him, he found all eyes on him. Sparks from the fire leapt high into the night sky, glittering in all the black eyes, watching him expectantly. They were waiting for him to speak now. Hoed had given him the honor of speaking last. His would be the story the Jer tribesmen carried with them to their sleep, an honor ordinarily reserved for the oldest and wisest among them, Hoed himself. Tully stood slowly, unable to put his feelings that moment into words.
What can I tell them? What could I say to them that they could possibly understand?
The dark eyes watched him. The murmur became a voice ringing in his ears.
Tell them! Tell them how you have failed!
Now an awkward silence spread through the waiting crowd. Tully felt their eyes on him.
I cannot.
He walked away from the circle of friends.
You did not think that I would let you leave me behind.
Esme's eyes glittered in the candlelight. Outside, the sky lightened in the east to a dull gray, becoming pearl-like pink near the horizon where the sun would rise. Bria smiled, the light softening her features.
In truth, Esme, I did not think you would care to come with me. It is a long journey to Dekra, and an uncertain errand at that. It is something I feel I must do.
And you must do it alone?
No. My mother will go with me.
And I will go with you, too. Chloe has already packed a few things for me, and as you see...
She indicated her riding clothes.
I am ready to go.
Then you shall come along by all means. Forgive me. I should have invited you. I merely thought that... Well, we will go together, and I will welcome the company.
It will make me feel useful to you. And I must admit that I have always wondered about this mysterious city of Dekra. There are many strange stories about it. Is it really enchanted?
Yes, but not the way you mean. Its enchantment grows from the love of its citizens. It is, as you shall see, a most remarkable place.
You have been there many times?
Not many, but a few times. Quentin and I would go there occasionally before the children were born. The last time was for Yasuf's funeral a few years ago. Quentin talked about going back there to stay, but after Yasuf died, he never spoke of it again. He is king, and the king must remain on his throne in Ascalon.
Bria shrugged, and Esme finished tying the points at her sleeves.
Now then, let us go wake the girls.
The little princesses were already awake when the two women entered the bedroom. Chloe was there, along with her own nurse, packing their clothes into carved chests for the journey.
Mother! Oh, Mother, is it true? Can they really go with you?
We will be good, and we will be quiet, we promise. Oh, please!
Yes, my darlings, you are coming with me. But I want you to remember that this is a long journey, and you will get very tired. You must do as I say, for we will travel quickly.
Are we to ride horses too?
Yes, horses!
You will ride in a coach with Grandmother. She will need someone to keep her company on the way.
Is Daddy going too?
No. The king is searching for Gerin and will not come with us. Hurry now and finish dressing. This stone floor is cold on your feet. We will wait for you in the yard. Chloe will bring you out when you are ready. Now run along.
Both girls scampered away to finish dressing. The two women crept back into the quiet corridors of Ascalon Castle and made their way down the hall to where a simple breakfast had been laid for them. There, Alenia was waiting, her trim form clothed in summer green, an embroidered tunic over trousers and tall riding boots. An image flashed into Bria's mind of her mother standing just so.
Goodbye, my daughter.
For a moment, she imagined this had all happened before, just this way.
Good morning, Mother. Have I ever seen you wear these clothes before?
Bria examined them carefully.
Yes, I believe you have. But I'm amazed that you would remember.
Then it came to her.
How could I ever forget? You were going off to rescue Father dressed like that. You had to sneak out of your own castle.
I thought I would just try them on and, well, they fit. So here I am. Do you approve?
How could I disapprove?
When they finished eating, they hurried out into the ward yard where the horses and coach were already waiting for them. The coachman was tying the last bundle of provisions to the frame behind the coach.
Wilkins!
My lady, when Lady Esme told me of your wish to go to Dekra, I thought it best to travel with you.
If you would rather have another...
No, it is a fine idea. I commend it and thank you both.
I am at your service.
Wilkins bowed again and touched the hilt of his sword. Bria was once again reminded that theirs was not a pleasure outing. From across the yard approached the warder, a man with short gray hair and gray eyes, whose sinews seemed made of whipcord.
Milady! Milady, I'm against this enterprise!
I know, Hagen, but there is no worry.
No worry? Your own son kidnapped, and you say no worry?
The man gave her a look of frank disapproval.
The king will have my hide stretched and nailed on yonder drawbridge if I let you go.
We will come to no harm. We travel with an escort of knights, and the king's roads are safe enough.
Then I shall go too.
No, I would rather have you here to await the king's return.
The warder held his tongue and said no more. Bria and Esme were helped into the saddle, Alenia into the coach, and the horses were led out through the yard toward the gatehouse, where two knights, mounted and ready, were waiting. There they paused, and Chloe and the princesses came running out to scramble into the coach. Hagen the warder, nephew of Pren, stood rooted to the spot until they had disappeared. Then he shook his head and stomped off. Ascalon lay but 2 leagues away. With a little speed, the tinker would arrive at midday, find himself a meal, and begin making his rounds. There were certain customers he visited every time he came to town. Milcher at the Grey Goose Inn, for example. He always needed a new pot or a pan repaired, and always included supper, too. Yes, he was one of the best customers. And there were others, the butcher's wife, the chandler's sister, the baker, and the weaver. In fact, all the merchants needed his services one time or another. Even the king's kitchen staff occasionally bought his wares.
A wee bit further, old Tip, and we'uns will stop a little in Ascalon. What say you there, eh? A nice grizzle bone for ye, eh, Tipper? And a hot, tasty meal. Ah, the innkeeper's wife makes the best meat pies in all Mensendor. There's a fact, Tip. The best! Makes me mouth water to think on it.
Tip took all this in with a benign, thoughtful expression and wagged her tail with appropriate enthusiasm, and they ambled down the road. Slowly, they came within sight of Ascalon Castle. Pim turned around, stepped to the side of the road, and waited for the rider to pass. In an instant, the white charger and its regal rider swept past them. Pim raised his hand in greeting, and the intent rider dipped his head in acknowledgement as he rode on by. The tinker followed the horseman into the distance with his eyes and continued on his way.
Ah, coming today, Tip, and we'uns will ride too. A wagon and a sharpening stone and a treadle foot. Ah, that's for we. We'uns found our fortune.
Pim gazed after the rider, disappearing into the distance.
But you know, I think that un was the king that passed by just now. I couldn't say for certain, but it might have been. Looked a king to me, would ye not say, Tipper, eh? Quite right, quite right. Looked a king. Maybe 'twas the king. Oh, the gods be with him, poor king. Terrible thing, terrible. His son snatched off like that. A terrible deed, most foul, that. Didn't I say it, Tip? A deed most foul. The gods be with thee, sire!
Pim squinted up an eye toward the sun, gauging the time of day. The morning shone fair and bright, the sky high and wide and blue. Across the green fields, farmers worked their land, coaxing grain out of the soil. Occasionally, the tinker would wave to one, who would answer his greeting likewise. Ahead, the town drew slowly closer, and the sun rose higher.
Tipper, we'uns best stir our bones, it'll be too late to get to our meal. Come along now.
You cannot be serious.
The high priest stared at the old man, as if unable to comprehend the words just spoken.
I assure you, I am.
But why? Why risk discovery now? It is not wise.
Not wise? You dare to presume wisdom beyond Nimrud's?
High Priest Plul paled and threw up his hands.
No! Oh, no! No! It's not that. Never! It's just that I thought that we are safe here. We have time now to think this through, plan our course of action. We must move very carefully, you would agree.
I have decided. There is nothing more to discuss. I will tell you what to do. I will make all the decisions from now on. You have nothing to fear if you do your part and see to it that your stupid priests do theirs. Leave all else to me.
The old wizard glared at the priest with malevolent glee.
You want to humble that usurper king, do you not? Ah, yes, I can see it on your face. You want him and his God Most High brought low before all Mensendor. Then you will be acknowledged and the power of the High Temple increased.
The High Priest could not resist a smile at the prospect.
Well then, do nothing, do you hear? Wait for me. I will return shortly and we can begin.
Pluel watched the old man, fearing him, loathing him, but his desire to flaunt his power over the throne crushed any resistance he might offer to Nimrud. Yes, to humble the proud king, to reassert the claims of the temple over the affairs of the realm, that was worth the price of putting up with a troublesome old long-beard Nimrud. It was worth the risk.
Very well. It shall be as you say.
Nimrud nodded and winked, and smiled his gruesome smile.
That is good, my pet. Do as I say, and all will be well.
Horse and rider jolted to a stop in the inner ward yard. Squires dashed up to take the king's well-lathered mount. Without a word, Quentin went straight into the castle, through the banquet hall filled with people still lingering over their midday meal, and onto the throne room. He flew up the steps to the dragon throne and threw off his soiled cloak as he collapsed into the throne.
Bring me my High Minister!
There was a flurry of footsteps, but no sign of Tolly. Quentin seethed inside. He had risen late, later than he had planned, and had started his journey to Ascalon after the sun was well up. This put him in a raw mood. Every stride was too slow after that, and he arrived in Ascalon harried, fuming, and out of patience. He had slept well enough, curled in his cloak on the farmer's own bed. The farmer's wife would not have it any other way but that the king should have their bed, and awakened feeling better than he had in days. But his tardy start and the dark thoughts of what awaited him in Ascalon soon destroyed the fragile peace he'd achieved.
Where's the High Minister?
There was no answer. Quentin sank deeper into his melancholy.
Find the High Minister! Well?
Quentin looked down to see Hagen, the warder, coming resolutely toward him.
Lord, you have returned.
Yes, I've returned. Where is everyone? Tell me quickly if you value your tongue.
Hagen appeared unperturbed. His clear gray eyes regarded Quentin unflinchingly. He was man enough for any monarch's moods.
They're gone, sire. All are gone.
All? What do you mean, all?
Everyone.
What are you blabbling about? Send for them at once.
It may not be, my lord.
The queen, where is she?
Her highness and the dowager and the children have left Ascalon. The Lady Esme with them. They ride for Dekra.
What? To Dekra? Why? Where did they leave?
Just before sunrise.
Quentin struck the arm of the throne with his fist. While he had dawdled on the road, his wife had left the castle. If he had not stopped, if only he had ridden on to Ascalon, he would have been here in time to detain her. She would not have gone if he were here.
Where is the High Minister?
He's disappeared, Your Majesty.
What?
He was last seen in attendance at the hermit's funeral, sire. After the burial, he disappeared. He did not return to the castle. It is believed he slipped away from the procession on the way back to Ascalon. No one has heard from him or seen him since.
Tolly has disappeared. Well, he might. If the prince is not found, it would be better if he never returned.
Thedo and Ronsard, have they arrived?
They arrived, my lord, and immediately took responsibility for the search party for the prince. They have gone as well.
That was it, then. All were gone, those he needed most to see. He was alone. The gnawing loneliness he had felt on the road was upon him once more. It was true. Everyone he cared about was gone. Here was a loneliness deeper than that of the temple. Then he had not known any different life, but now he had not been so deserted in years. Every day he was surrounded by his closest friends and loved ones, every single day. He thought it would never end, that the closeness, the love, would go on forever. But sadly, he was wrong. In 3 short days, already it seemed a lifetime, his world had been shattered and the pieces scattered by some cruel fate. Nothing remained now of the happiness he had so recently possessed.
Sire?
Quentin stirred himself. The warder was looking at him strangely.
I asked if that would be all, sire.
Yes, that'd be all. Go now. Leave me.
There, in the dim interior of his throne room, the king gave himself over to the hopelessness that assailed him, sinking deeper and still deeper beneath the crushing weight of despair.